Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus.
I want to talk to you tonight, like I did last week, about a subject rather than a Bible book. Usually in our courses, we study, like we did Proverbs for a year, and we did the Gospel of Mark, which we just finished a fortnight ago, and we try to go through a section of Bible each week and see what it says to us as 21st century people. But last week I was motivated, and this week I'm motivated yet again to talk in a topical way about something that has been riveting me in its, demand on our lives. And our response to that will tell how we will live. And I think that we need to have some practical conversation at times, as well as theological practical conversation about what the Bible had to say. And tonight I want to talk about a subject called white space, or margin. That's correct. It's not about computers, but computers will play into our conversation tonight. What actually triggered this was about a week and a half ago. I was walking on the Sydney Uni campus, handing out leaflets. And I was flashing back on the time when I was at uni, which was, 100 years ago, and I was handing things out, and people would take them or interact with me straight away. There was almost immediate conversation. Hey, what's this about? Because we were activists in our hippie days. And when I became a believer and started a congregation in Lawrence, Kansas, by doing the very same thing I'd been doing as an activist, we were handing out leaflets. And people were, hey, what's cool? What's happening? Oh, yeah, what are you for? Save the whales, save the program, save the planet, save something. And we wanted to know what it was. So I said, well, it's about Yeshua or about Jesus or Jesucristo, depending on with whom I was speaking. And or I'd talk about the topic that was on the cover of the thing, whether it was inflation or abortion or ecosystems or whatever it was that began the conversation. It always ended up with, therefore, you need to follow Yeshua. And that's how they all end. Well, here I was at Sydney Uni campus, and the next day I was experiencing the exact same thing that happened when I was at New South Wales University. While people came by and they had a smile on their face, they had absolutely no visual of me. They had iPods in their ears with the cables. They had hands full of mobiles texting, or they were on the phone talking. Now, they're walking alongside almost in a march to the next class, and yet they are not talking to the person next to them. They're actually, some of them, texting the person next to them. That's what I heard. I just found this unbelievably bizarre. Well, what about it is our society? That's what you say, it's our society, and that's what is helping me think this through. What exactly is that? What do we call that? Technology is just a tool. But did it take over? When does the servant become the master? When does the master become the servant? Yeah, this whole idea of technological advances forcing us back in the back. And there's a social utility many started with called MySpace. Then the next social utility came out as Facebook. And it swept across everybody. Now the latest social utility is Twitter. Twitter is basically a conversation technique between a person and a series of people who sign up to be twitted, who will now communicate. The person communicates every 10 minutes within 59 characters what he's been doing, what she's doing right now. I'm sitting in class. Twit. 10 minutes later, I'm still sitting in class. I'm chewing gum. I was thinking about tomorrow. What's for dinner? These are, to every 10 minutes, a person can send a Twitter conversation that's monologue, really. It's one way, it communicates something, and for some amazing reason, people care what you are doing every 10 minutes. So on my Facebook page, I put a note some months ago saying, I'm not going to Twitter. A line has to be drawn somewhere. I don't think anybody really cares that I'm deciding between a blue shirt and a yellow shirt at 7 a.m. And I really should have other things to do in my life as besides tell them my constant need to barrage people with my life. Well, I point to these as examples of the lack of white space, the lack of margin in our lives. When you get home from your life, you're out, you're about, you come home, think through honestly, what do? You put down your bags, you put down your briefcases, you put down your purses, and if nothing is on, the first thing most people do is reach for some noise to turn on. A remote control to fill up our ears or eyes and ears with television or radio. Maybe, if you're not into that, music. If you haven't already been listening to your iPod and MP3 players. There's something about noise that fills us full. And it is a fearful life for most people when they stop by woods on a snowy evening. When they listen to nothing. When they go for a walk and see two roads diverged in the yellow wood and sorry they can't travel both. It's scary to not be advised and not have noise going. It's so pleasant to drive to, say, Broken Hill or Dubbo.
Sure.
There are substantive realities about noise and marginless. You look at that Bible you have. Mine's on the computer. Just open it up anywhere. And what do you see around the edges?
White margins.
But why? You know, what a waste. There's all that good paper, and we could save a lot of paper. Stop killing trees. If we went all the way to the top, all the way to the width, all the way to the bottom. But there's something uncomfortable about marginless books, isn't there? We think, you know, give me some space. One of the most important books I've ever read was written in 1992. It's by a medical doctor named Richard Swenson. The title of the book is Margin, Restoring Emotional, Physical, Financial, and Time Reserves to Overloaded Lives. This in 1992, before the internet had swept across. If he rewrote this, which he may well have by now, he would have to redo several chapters about noise and television being the most significant medium that was invading the home, because now everybody's got mobiles. I remember in 1992 I had a mobile that was almost like a purse, and it really was one of those Maxwell smart telephones in a zippered pouch. Hello, Chief. He didn't know a thing about this in those days, but I want you to listen to a couple of these quotes from Swenson that I think are very significant. He says, long before our nanosecond culture, frustration with time urgency was apparent. Already in 200 BC, Plautus was cursing the sundial. Here's what he said, quote, the gods confound the man who first found out how to distinguish hours. Confound him too. Who in this place set up a sundial to cut and hack my days so wretchedly into small portions? Now, that doesn't bother me to know what time it is, but realize this, my hand watch. Look, it wasn't until 1865 that wristwatches were invented. The first mechanical clocks were alarms of sorts introduced around 1200 AD. Only a bell indicated time. In the 1300s, they added the dial and hour hand. It wasn't until the 1600s when they put the minute hand in, and second hands added just a little while later. The invasion of the wristwatch, 1865, about the same time Matthew Arnold, famous essayist, penned his famous The Scholar Gypsy. A coincidence, perhaps, but still one wonders, and he quotes, oh, born in days when wits were fresh and clear, and life ran gaily as the sparkling Thames. Before this strange disease of modern life, with its sick hurry, its divided aims, its heads o'ertaxed, its palsied hearts, was rife, fly hence our contact fear. He says, if the clock broke up the day, then Edison broke up the night. with electricity and night. And now borders, which should be natural in life. The sun sets and everything calms down. The birds stop flying, don't they? The animals go into a different mode, and we should. But we don't. The light goes down, and you just came back from Buenos Aires, the city of lights in the southern hemisphere, and what do? Vamos. Let's go to a fiesta. Let's go bailando at a tango place. You know, let's get out because there's life to happen. And it starts not at 6 o'clock when the sun sets. Dinner starts at 10 o'clock, and then you go to the pubs and to the dancing places. Now, many of those people go to work the next day. That's right, the same day. And you think, how in the world can they do that? And the reality is, they cannot. So productivity goes down. Energy for work goes down. And we merely work and survive so that we can have funds and resource and energy to go out at night and continue to party. It is a ruthless cycle if we don't give ourselves downtime or margin. Let me tell you a couple other things. He's a medical doctor, and he talks about the problems emotionally in stress in this regard. He says that as relevant as the specifics are, the overarching theme of this chapter focuses not on the specifics but on the parent pain overload. And that was in 1992. Number one, activity overload. We're booked up weeks in advance. You know, I leave tomorrow for the States. I'll be gone for a fortnight. We're booked up weeks in advance. So I'm telling you, I'm going to Kansas City tomorrow in the States, and I have 3 appointments with individuals, those appointments I made months ago, saying I'm going to be in Kansas City at this time, I've got this day, maybe we could meet in the Arvo, and I've got this morning, maybe. And they responded, and we've set it up. I'm preaching about 14 or 15 times in that fortnight, and all of those preachments were lined up to a year ago. Now, activity overload, huh? We're a busy people. In an attempt to squeeze more things in, we try to do 2 or 3 at the same time. And if you're a male, you can't do it. Women can multitask, but we're in trouble. Activity overload, he says, takes away the pleasure of anticipation and the delight of reminiscence. In other words, our future is bound and our past is bound in forgetfulness, because we're so subsumed and consumed with making sure our diaries are full, and we don't want to miss an appointment, and we don't want to miss a making of an appointment, etc. That's activity. Secondly, change overload. Nothing defines our age more than the furious and relentless increase in the rate of change. That's what Arthur Schlesinger Jr. said. He's a historian. For millennia upon millennia, change was slow, controlled, accessible. Now it convulses at warp speed. Now, at the back of this book, he has a series of charts, and you'll see something very clearly as I show you this. I feel like I'm on Romper Room or something. Look at these charts. They all look the same. Every one of them begins to look alike. It's an exponential, almost logarithmic chart on each of these categories. Let me tell you what some of them are. Information, from 1900 to 1960, pretty steady, and then kaboom, it exploded. What's this? Complexity of life. Kaboom, change, boom. Every one of these categories, look at these. Gross national product, I guess that's good, that money was coming in furiously. Internal revenue collections, that's tax. Gross federal debt, this is just America, but we have our own health here. National defense expenditures, look at that, steady, 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 boom, with a little bubble there in 1940 from the war. Bankruptcies, and if you think that's bad, you've seen it now since September, a huge volume. So the whole thing is exploding. Bank closings, 1980, it hit high, and then it started dropping down through the 80s, but then certainly in the last few years and the last 6 months, we've seen so many banks gobbled up. So he puts them all in the same lump. You can see the chart going up. Cost of existing homes, health care costs. So everything, though we're appreciably gaining as far as gross national product, we're also increasing our number of prisoners in a lightning high exponential run. Our divorces are bursting. The births to unmarried women, look at that, exploding. Volume of mail, volume of advertising, new books published, I guess that's good, if you can keep up with margin in your life. volume of junk mail, foreign travel, population of the world. You see how everything in this 20th and now 21st century is bursting. And what this great doctor has done is help me, and I've read this a couple times, and I should give myself to it again, help me to see that more is not necessarily better. I think summary of my life since 92 and reading this is so useful. Maintaining marginless living is not going to be easy. You've got to have margin. So some people say, I've just got to have some space. I got to chill. We use all these terms, but at the end of the day, what we're seeing is not just the complexification of life, but our own tiredness on the increase. So what do we do? How do you solve that? Is it easy to evaluate your own moreness and move it towards lessness? Pardon that bad English. Before you get all frazzled and bang your head against a wall? Before you explode in the library saying, I can't handle this noise, and there's nobody talking. Look with me at something rhythmic. I want you to see it. It's in Exodus chapter 20. Exodo capitulo 20, Shemot. This is what God said. The Lord spoke to all these words, and he said this, I'm the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what's in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day, to keep it holy. 6 days out of seven, you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work. You or your son or your daughter, your male, female servant, pretty much everything, everybody, anything you can consider. Your cattle, the stranger, the sojourner who stays with you. Why? For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and there's nothing left out. All that is in them. He rested on the seventh day, therefore the Lord blessed the seventh day, and he made it holy. The commands go on. You know, there's nothing in nature that says 7 days. There are, on every one of us, 10 fingers. On every one of us, 10 toes. We have 2 ears, 2 eyes, 2 legs, 1 head, 1 nose. We have multiples of ones and twos and tens. That would make sense. The sun goes around and we do the month, and it's about 30 days, 31, depending on the knuckle we're on that day. It's 28, it's 29, it's 30, it's 31, right? It's around 30, which is 3 times 10. That would make sense. The tides come and go in the morning and in the evening. There is nothing but dailiness to those. What is there in humanity that says 7? Besides Star City, what is there that says 7? You don't have, there's nothing natural that says 7. You know, if you go up to Chiang Mai, Thailand, and go on a Thursday, and a Friday, and a Saturday, Sunday, Monday, whatever day you're there, you'll find every person in their shop every day. They're there 7 days a week. We think, ah, that's terrible. They should have 40-hour work weeks, or if you're in France, 36-hour or 33-hour work weeks. We need unions to support us as we fight against child labor laws. But end of the day, outside of safety and health regulations, the world is pretty much a 7-day-a-week, everyday thing.
In Russia, under the communist regime, they tried to make a 10-day working week. They did try.
To do 9 and take the 10th off?
No, 10 days.
Work 10,
work 10 days.
Take an 11th off? Or,
something like
or
that.
Or 2 days at the
they
end.
They tried to make a 10-day week instead of the 7th because they didn't believe in God and they wanted to make it a 10-day week.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, but it failed.
Well, yeah, you can't leave God out of the picture because he's in the picture.
It failed.
Why is it too long? You know, the tides come, tides go. The only reason you and I believe that it's too long is because of this commandment. Because of God creating the earth, it took him 6 days. Now, you know, my belief on that is, why did it take him so long? Not why did it take him so short. 6 days, he spoke, and it was. He created it, boom, it was. All right, give it a whole day. He even had margin in his creation, didn't he? I believe that Yeshua well understood this principle of taking a day off. I don't think it is the only thing he did. In fact, when Yeshua walked into the place, wherever he was, let's take a look at some of those. When he walked into places on the Sabbath, Yeshua made it into a different kind of day. In Matthew chapter 12, verse 1 to 8, Yeshua makes it very clear as he's teaching, as they're walking and they grab some food on the side of the road, that the boys are not breaking the Sabbath. The Pharisees who were there, who might have been part of a spy mob to make sure and check out things and catch him out when he does something wrong, said, "Behold," which means, "Hey, don't miss this, buddy. Your disciples do what's not lawful." In other words, what we don't say is right. And he said, "Well, you don't know your Bible very well." And he began to instruct them a couple times. And then he said, even if they did break the law, which they didn't, somebody greater than your Torah is here. And he pointed to himself and said, "The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." Now let's go on. And from verse 9 to verse 14. Yeshua brings life to a man on the Sabbath. He heals on the Sabbath. It's against the law to heal on the Sabbath. Pikuach nefesh. But is this man's nefesh really in trouble? And that's what they were arguing. It's not that his soul is in trouble or his life is on the line. He's just got a withered hand. And Yeshua chose to heal on Shabbat, Achsalachas, just to spite the guys who said they were in charge. So now he's evidencing what he's just claimed, that he's the Lord of the Sabbath. I'm the Lord of it. In fact, I'm going to go into synagogue and show you what I'm doing on Sabbath. Now, according to Exodus 20, what does God do on the Sabbath?
He rests.
So does that include healing? Generally, no. Generally, no. We'd say, no, he's chilling. He's watching the footy on TV, or, you know, he's having a drink by the lake or something. That's our picture of rest. But since the fall of man, God has been involved in our lives in such a way that he wants to restore us to himself, back to himself, so that we can all rest at the end of days. Yeshua, who evidenced what God's plan was from the beginning, takes that and goes to the shul, heals a guy. I mean, he didn't really touch him, did he? He just said, "Stretch out your hand." So the withered hand now stretches out. And Yeshua's words bring life. And the people were really upset. Now, this takes a lot out of you. It takes a lot out of you to be a minister and to battle the grain pickers and the nitpickers and the people who pick on you when you're in synagogue. So what does Yeshua do when he's stretched to the maximum of his white space on his page? Look at the next verse. Yeshua, verse number 15, aware of this, withdrew from there. Yeshua still healed people. It was still Shabbat. He still did stuff. But he withdrew from there. He took himself out of active ministry for a moment and walked back into a private place. We see that in the Garden of Gethsemane, didn't we? We see that in his healing of the man who's born blind. We see it when he does all kinds of miracles. After he fed 5,000, he withdrew. They got into a boat and he went across to the other side of Galil. So you see, something is going on where Yeshua is helping us understand it's not Saturday, it's not Tuesday, it's not any particular day. It's when you are maxed out in your life that you need to withdraw. Shabbat is the principle. Yeshua is the one who's informed us how exactly that principle plays out. I don't need to say, "Well, it's Friday night, 6 o'clock. Yikes, I better hurry." I love it in the region around here. You know, Friday at 10 o'clock in the morning, they're all zooming around trying to, they're getting their, gosh, they're like chooks with their heads cut off. And I got to get the challahs, and I got this special thing, I got the kids, I got to get a hurry, I got to vacuum, I got, for what? So that you can rest? Don't make such, Yeshua would say, chill. He would say, take off your watch. If you make it, you make it. If you don't, relax already. If you're trying to enter into Shabbat, enter already. If you're not, then don't give me all these blazing historic histrionics of stuff that you're doing so that you're pushing the margin, and it'll take you, how long does it take you when you're pushing before Shabbat falls to get into rest? You know, it takes hours, doesn't it? you went on this holiday, and how long did it take you before you really chilled? Yeah, and a lot of people do that. You know, they're so anxious to get everything done before they leave that they never really have left. And then they're worried while they're on the road. They're checking their Twitters. They're checking their Blackberries. They're checking all these things because, God forbid, I should miss something. Look at Luke chapter 13 from 10 to 16. Do you love these stories? I mean, this is real. This is our master. This is our hero. This is our savior. This is at least a noble activity of a great guy. But look what he does. He not only heals, he teaches. He teaches, and then he teaches against people. That is, he chides them. You hypocrites, verse 15. Look, you're more concerned about a donkey or an ox than you are this woman. You missed the plot, and Yeshua is not going to miss it. And so all the synagogue officials said, hey, you should do this on Tuesday or Thursday. But he's saying of himself something that's pretty spectacular. Yeshua is saying, I'm the creator, and I'm going to reestablish what Shabbat is about. And he does take time off, and he does work, but he's not bound to the same 6 day plus one cycle that he's instructed the Jewish people about. And I want that to be in my heart as well. I know that sometimes I fly, like tomorrow I'll fly on Friday at 2 o'clock, and I'm going to America. So back here, it'll be Shabbat. Well, what's the principle about it? The law, I can understand the law. Get in before and make sure you're seated, make sure you've got the lift lit, make sure everything's good, and then chill. No, basically I'm going to postpone that for a flight. I'm going to get into Kansas City at 7 o'clock p.m. on Friday night. And then I'm going to take the Shabbat. I'm going to do it then. I'm going to enter into rest, and I'm going to enjoy some friends and company of some believers. We're going to light the lights. We're going to drink the wine. We're going to enjoy God and each other. And I'm not worried about the particulars of what hour it is or what day it even is, because what Yeshua wants us to understand is the principle of the thing. Now, before the 1517, before the Protestant Reformation, people used to think, like so many, I suppose, in modern Jewish world, in the Catholic Church, they thought that the only people who were really serving God were those who were wearing collars, and they were in nuns' convents, they were the monks, they were the holy people. And you, well, you know, you're not as holy. And I know that that's transferred into a lot of Jewish circles as well, where we think, well, the rabbi, he's up there, the Kohens, you know, they're pretty important on certain festivals. But me, you know, I'm just a shlub. You know, what do I know? What do I get? I don't have, I'm nothing. And I'm somebody, and I'm pretty significant. But in Shul, you know, if somebody wants to know something, they'll let them go ask the rabbi. And we build in a clergy-laity kind of system that's not biblical. But in 1517, Martin Luther, and before him some others, had done something in previous emanations of the new Reformed Church, said, no, anybody can be a servant of God. So the miller and the baker and the dressmaker could all be serving God. This notion of the priesthood of all believers rose up. And the ordinary work that you and I do could be seen as substantially holy. I didn't have to wear a collar. I didn't have to go to a theological seminary for 9 years in Oxford and learn Greek, Latin, etc. I could be a holy person. And as a result, this idea of ordinariness was moved up several notches. Charles Taylor, in his book Sources of the Self, comments on the benefits of the Protestant Reformation, affirming ordinary life, bringing holiness to normalcy. Nuns and priests could marry. The miller and the priest and the wife and the mother and the baker were equally holy and equally brought God honor and were equally noble, Taylor says. Ordinary life then took on the sacred. Moderns negate this. Now just think through this. And they lose touch with the sacredness of the ordinary. So you get people in Sydney's southwest and west who are shooting each other as they do drive-bys, who are trying to gain more. They're going to more pubs and more clubs and more action centers so they can accrue to themselves something, because thrills and excitement and adventure and even tattooing devilish things on us will bring us something of a sacredness. Because we have, as a culture, dismissed God, then the banality of the ordinary is increased, and we're looking to fill it with something. Instead of saying, God loves me in my ordinary life. We say, where's the thrill? And I'm going to jump on a bungee thing, and I'm going to try to find new meaning and work harder and longer hours, and I'm going to try to accrue to myself stuff. Hence the lack of margin. Hence the pushing of the envelope, as we call it, so that we can find the very thing that God's standing in the middle of our page is offering us. Eternal life, pleasure, calm, Shabbat on any day. Maybe that's why people Twitter. They're trying to find something to fill their lives with. Whereas the ordinary is okay. In the morning yesterday, I got up and I saw one of the most lovely sunrises I think I'd seen in years. It was early and I was standing on my porch in Lane Cove, and there were the glimmers, and then there was this red ray, and then there was this orange, and then it widened, and I can't describe it, I can just enjoy it. I stood there and I watched, and pretty quickly then, the sun was up. And then all through the day, the sun is pretty boring. You know, it's yellow, there it is, it's flying, there it is, and the sundial guys could sort it out, and there it is. But then at the end of the day, sunsets, are they nice or what? Do you like the middle of the day? Not the same. Boring. I wonder who came up with the word boring. I should Google that and find out who invented the word aburrido, right? And find out who invented this word, because you know, it's the kind of thing you tell your children, don't tell me you're bored, you solve it. I don't have to do that. I'm not the entertainment committee, you figure it out. But I think this idea of accruing to ourself excitement and thrills is being a malcontent in the midst of the sunshine all day, saying, I've got to have morning, or I've got to have the thrill of sunrise or sunset. Most of the day is ordinary. Most of the day, get this, is boring. Sure, morning sunrise, late sunset, gorgeous, thrilling, pleasurable, but most of the day isn't that. Most of my life, even as a missionary, most of my life, though I meet with people, and I had such a great phone call yesterday with this 52-year-old Jewish woman named Judah, who just got saved yesterday. We've been working with her for months, and now, boom, she came through, and I'm ready to take the plunge, she said, which meant baptism. I didn't know it was so literal. But she sorted it out, and she had stopped asking the wrong questions, she said, all the why questions, and moved into the what questions. I think about her and the thrill that was for me, but you know, most of my life handing out flyers at unis, answering telephone calls, answering emails, chatting with people, driving to the office, driving home from the office, being with my kids, whom I love, my son, who's very famous now, my wife, who's not famous, but I love her. Pretty ordinary life. People say, what'd you do for your wife's birthday? I said, we went to dinner. You know, is that thrilling? You know, it was nice. It was a lovely dinner. We went to the city. We ate at a nice place. So it was kind of midday, wasn't it? It was kind of ordinary. But brothers and sisters, I'm not sad about ordinary. It's well within the confines of my life, and I've got good margin around it. And we could talk about, and I'll let you read Swenson one day. It really, I should sell it here. It is such a good book. Maybe I'll get some when I go to the States and bring some back. I think it is a life-changing kind of book, almost like What's So Amazing About Grace. It is the kind of thing you have to do with, what does he say, economics, financial, physical, emotional, and time. We've just commented on time and a little bit of emotion. But financially, you need margin so that you're not living paycheck to paycheck. Physical, you need margin so you're not always rushing to get to the, I've just got to get there. Yeah. But I've got to hurry. We've got to finish this so that I can get to that, so that I can enjoy life. And most of life happens in the boring daytime. Luke chapter 10, the disciples come back and say, hey, Lord, we saw all kinds of exciting stuff. Demons subject to us in your name. We were there at sunrise. We were there in the sunset. He said, yeah, nevertheless, don't rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are recorded in heaven. You know, end of the day, it's the boring, it's the middle of the page that's going to keep us going. Don't need the marginless life. Enjoy the pleasure of God in the ordinary, and I think we'll be getting along pretty well.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact us at Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia, 2001. God bless you.